23 soldiers, 3 officers, and 2 officials were confined in the shed in which Pierre had been placed, and where he remained for 4 weeks. When Pierre remembered them afterwards, they all seemed misty figures to him, except Platon Karatayev, who always remained in his mind a most vivid and precious memory, and the personification of everything Russian, kindly, and round. When Pierre saw his neighbor next morning at dawn, the first impression of him, as of something round, was fully confirmed. Platon's whole figure, in a French overcoat girdled with a cord, a soldier's cap, and bast shoes, was round. His head was quite round. His back, chest, shoulders, and even his arms, which he held as if ever ready to embrace something, were rounded. His pleasant smile and his large, gentle brown eyes were also round. Platon Karatayev must have been 50, judging by his stories of campaigns he had been in, told as by an old soldier. He did not himself know his age and was quite unable to determine it. But his brilliantly white, strong teeth, which showed in 2 unbroken semicircles when he laughed, as he often did, were all sound and good. There was not a gray hair in his beard or on his head, and his whole body gave an impression of suppleness, and especially of firmness and endurance. His face, despite its fine, rounded wrinkles, had an expression of innocence and youth. His voice was pleasant and musical. But the chief peculiarity of his speech was its directness and appositeness. It was evident that he never considered what he had said or was going to say, and consequently the rapidity and justice of his intonation had an irresistible persuasiveness. His physical strength and agility during the first days of his imprisonment was such that he seemed not to know what fatigue and sickness meant. Every night before lying down he said, "Lord, lay me down as a stone and raise me up as a loaf." And every morning on getting up he said, "I lay down and curled up, I get up and shake myself." And indeed he only had to lie down to fall asleep like a stone, and he only had to shake himself to be ready without a moment's delay for some work, just as children are ready to play directly they awake. He could do everything, not very well, but not badly. He baked, cooked, sewed, planed, and mended boots. He was always busy, and only at night allowed himself conversation, of which he was fond, and songs. He did not sing like a trained singer who knows he is listened to, but like the birds, evidently giving vent to the sounds in the same way that one stretches oneself or walks about to get rid of stiffness. And the sounds were always high-pitched, mournful, delicate, and almost feminine, and his face at such times was very serious. Having been taken prisoner and allowed his beard to grow, he seemed to have thrown off all that had been forced upon him, everything military and alien to himself, and had returned to his former peasant habits. "A soldier on leave, a shirt outside breeches," he would say. He did not like talking about his life as a soldier, though he did not complain, and often mentioned that he had not been flogged once during the whole of his army service. When he related anything, it was generally some old and evidently precious memory of his Christian life, as he called his peasant existence. The proverbs of which his talk was full were for the most part not the coarse and indecent saws soldiers employ, but those folk sayings which, taken without a context, seem so insignificant, but when used appositely, suddenly acquire a significance of profound wisdom. He would often say the exact opposite of what he had said on a previous occasion, yet both would be right. He liked to talk, and he talked well, adorning his speech with terms of endearment and with folk sayings which Pierre thought he invented himself. But the chief charm of his talk lay in the fact that the commonest events, sometimes just such as Pierre had witnessed without taking notice of them, assumed in Karatayev's speech a character of solemn fitness. He liked to hear the folk tales one of the soldiers used to tell of an evening. They were always the same. But most of all, he liked to hear stories of real life. He would smile joyfully when listening to such stories, now and then putting in a word or asking a question to make the moral beauty of what he was told clear to himself. Karatayev had no attachments, friendships, or love, as Pierre understood them, but loved and lived affectionately with everything life brought him in contact with, particularly with man. Not any particular man, but those with whom he happened to be. He loved his dog, his comrades, the French, and Pierre, who was his neighbor. But Pierre felt that in spite of Karatayev's affectionate tenderness for him, by which he unconsciously gave Pierre's spiritual life its due, he would not have grieved for a moment at parting from him. And Pierre began to feel in the same way toward Karatayev. To all the other prisoners, Platon Karatayev seemed a most ordinary soldier. They called him Little Falcon or Platosha, chaffed him good-naturedly, and sent him on errands. But to Pierre, he always remained what he had seemed that first night, an unfathomable, rounded, eternal personification of the spirit of simplicity and truth. Platon Karatayev knew nothing by heart except his prayers. When he began to speak, he seemed not to know how he would conclude. Sometimes Pierre, struck by the meaning of his words, would ask him to repeat them, but Platon could never recall what he had said a moment before, just as he never could repeat to Pierre the words of his favorite song. Native and birch tree and my heart is sick occurred in it, but when spoken and not sung, no meaning could be got out of it. He did not and could not understand the meaning of words apart from their context. Every word and action of his was the manifestation of an activity unknown to him, which was his life. But his life, as he regarded it, had no meaning as a separate thing. It had meaning only as a part of a whole of which he was always conscious. His words and actions flowed from him as evenly, inevitably, and spontaneously as fragrance exhales from a flower. He could not understand the value or significance of any word or deed taken separately. Chapter 4. Princess Mary goes to the Rostovs in Yaroslavl. Prince Andrew's last days and death. When Princess Mary heard from Nicholas that her brother was with the Rostovs at Yaroslavl, she at once prepared to go there, in spite of her aunt's efforts to dissuade her, and not merely to go herself, but to take her nephew with her. Whether it were difficult or easy, possible or impossible, she did not ask and did not want to know. It was her duty not only herself to be near her brother, who was perhaps dying, but to do everything possible to take his son to him, and so she prepared to set off. That she had not heard from Prince Andrew himself, Princess Mary attributed to his being too weak to write, or to his considering the long journey too hard and too dangerous for her and his son. In a few days, Princess Mary was ready to start. Her equipages were the huge family coach in which she had traveled to Voronezh, a semi-open trap, and a baggage cart. With her traveled Mademoiselle Bourienne, little Nicholas and his tutor, her old nurse, three maids, Tichon, and a young footman and courier her aunt had sent to accompany her. The usual route through Moscow could not be thought of, and the roundabout way Princess Mary was obliged to take through Lipetsk, Ryazan, Vladimir, and Shuya was very long, and as post horses were not everywhere obtainable, very difficult. And near Ryazan, where the French were said to have shown themselves, was even dangerous. During this difficult journey, Mademoiselle Bourienne, de Salles, and Princess Mary's servants were astonished at her energy and firmness of spirit. She went to bed later and rose earlier than any of them, and no difficulties daunted her. Thanks to her activity and energy, which infected her fellow travelers, they approached Yaroslavl by the end of the second week. The last days of her stay in Voronezh had been the happiest of her life. Her love for Rostov no longer tormented or agitated her. It filled her whole soul, had become an integral part of herself, and she no longer struggled against it. Latterly, she had become convinced that she loved and was beloved, though she never said this definitely to herself in words. She had become convinced of it at her last interview with Nicholas, when he had come to tell her that her brother was with the Rostovs. Not by a single word had Nicholas alluded to the fact that Prince Andrew's relations with Natasha might, if he recovered, be renewed, but Princess Mary saw by his face that he knew and thought of this. Yet, in spite of that, his relation to her, considerate, delicate, and loving, not only remained unchanged, but it sometimes seemed to Princess Mary that he was even glad that the family connection between them allowed him to express his friendship more freely. She knew that she loved for the first and only time in her life, and felt that she was beloved, and was happy in regard to it. But this happiness on one side of her spiritual nature did not prevent her feeling grief for her brother with full force. On the contrary, that spiritual tranquility on the one side, made it the more possible for her to give full play to her feeling for her brother. That feeling was so strong at the moment of leaving Voronezh that those who saw her off, as they looked at her careworn, despairing face, felt sure she would fall ill on the journey. But the very difficulties and preoccupations of the journey, which she took so actively in hand, saved her for a while from her grief and gave her strength. As always happens when traveling, Princess Mary thought only of the journey itself, forgetting its object. But as she approached Yaroslavl, the thought of what might await her there, not after many days, but that very evening, again presented itself to her, and her agitation increased to its utmost limit. The courier, who had been sent on in advance to find out where the Rostovs were staying in Yaroslavl and in what condition Prince Andrew was, when he met the big coach just entering the town gates, was appalled by the terrible pallor of the princess's face that looked out at him from the window. "I've found out everything, Your Excellency. The Rostovs are staying at the merchant Bronikov's house in the square not far from here, right above the Volga," said the courier. Princess Mary looked at him with frightened inquiry, not understanding why he did not reply to what she chiefly wanted to know. How was her brother? Mademoiselle Bourienne put that question for her. "How is the prince?" she asked. "His Excellency is staying in the same house with them." "Then he is alive," thought Princess Mary, and asked in a low voice, "How is he?" "The servants say he's still the same." What "still the same" might mean, Princess Mary did not ask. But with an unnoticed glance at little 7-year-old Nicholas, who was sitting in front of her looking with pleasure at the town, she bowed her head and did not raise it again till the heavy coach, rumbling, shaking, and swaying, came to a stop. The carriage steps clattered as they were let down. The carriage door was opened. On the left there was water, a great river, and on the right a porch. There were people at the entrance, servants, and a rosy girl with a large plait of black hair, smiling, as it seemed to Princess Mary, in an unpleasantly affected way. This was Sonya. Princess Mary ran up the steps. This way," said the girl with the same artificial smile, and the princess found herself in the hall, facing an elderly woman of Oriental type, who came rapidly to meet her with a look of emotion. This was the countess. She embraced Princess Mary and kissed her. "Mon enfant, my child," she muttered, "je vous aime et vous connais depuis longtemps. I love you and have known you a long time." Despite her excitement, Princess Mary realized that this was the countess and that it was necessary to say something to her. Hardly knowing how she did it, she contrived to utter a few polite phrases in French in the same tone as those that had been addressed to her, and asked, "How is he?" "The doctor says that he's not in danger," said the countess. But as she spoke, she raised her eyes with a sigh, and her gesture conveyed a contradiction of her words. "Where is he? Can I see him? Can I?" asked the princess. "One moment, princess, one moment, my dear. Is this his son?" said the countess, turning to little Nicholas, who was coming in with de Salle. "There will be room for everybody. This is a big house. Oh, what a lovely boy." The countess took Princess Mary into the drawing-room, where Sonya was talking to Mademoiselle Bourienne. The countess caressed the boy, and the old count came in and welcomed the princess. He had changed very much since Princess Mary had last seen him. Then he had been a brisk, cheerful, self-assured old man. Now he seemed a pitiful, bewildered person. While talking to Princess Mary, he continually looked round, as if asking everyone whether he was doing the right thing. After the destruction of Moscow and of his property, thrown out of his accustomed groove, he seemed to have lost the sense of his own significance and to feel that there was no longer a place for him in life. In spite of her one desire to see her brother as soon as possible, and her vexation that at the moment when all she wanted was to see him, they should be trying to entertain her and pretending to admire her nephew, the princess noticed all that was going on around her, and felt the necessity of submitting for a time to this new order of things which she had entered. She knew it to be necessary, and though it was hard for her, she was not vexed with these people. "This is my niece," said the count, introducing Sonya. You don't know her, Princess? Princess Mary turned to Sonya, and trying to stifle the hostile feeling that arose in her toward the girl, she kissed her. But she felt oppressed by the fact that the mood of everyone around her was so far from what was in her own heart. "Where is he?" she asked again, addressing them all. "He's downstairs. Natasha is with him," answered Sonya, flushing. "We've sent to ask. I think you must be tired, Princess." Tears of vexation showed themselves in Princess Mary's eyes. She turned away and was about to ask the Countess again how to go to him, when light, impetuous, and seemingly buoyant steps were heard at the door. The Princess looked round and saw Natasha coming in, almost running. That Natasha whom she had liked so little at their meeting in Moscow long since. But hardly had the Princess looked at Natasha's face before she realized that here was a real comrade in her grief, and consequently a friend. She ran to meet her, embraced her, and began to cry on her shoulder. As soon as Natasha, sitting at the head of Prince Andrew's bed, heard of Princess Mary's arrival, she softly left his room and hastened to her with those swift steps that had sounded buoyant to Princess Mary. There was only one expression on her agitated face when she ran into the drawing room, that of love, boundless love for him, for her, and for all that was near to the man she loved, and of pity, suffering for others, and passionate desire to give herself entirely to helping them. It was plain that at that moment there was in Natasha's heart no thought of herself or of her own relations with Prince Andrew. Princess Mary, with her acute sensibility, understood all this at the first glance at Natasha's face, and wept on her shoulder with sorrowful pleasure. "Come, come to him, Mary," said Natasha, leading her into the other room. Princess Mary raised her head, dried her eyes, and turned to Natasha. She felt that from her she would be able to understand and learn everything. She began her question, but stopped short. She felt that it was impossible to ask or to answer in words. Natasha's face and eyes would have to tell her all more clearly and profoundly. Natasha was gazing at her, but seemed afraid and in doubt whether to say all she knew or not. She seemed to feel that before those luminous eyes which penetrated into the very depths of her heart, it was impossible not to tell the whole truth which she saw. And suddenly, Natasha's lips twitched, ugly wrinkles gathered round her mouth, and covering her face with her hands, she burst into sobs. Princess Mary understood, but she still hoped, and asked in words she herself did not trust, "But how is his wound? What is his general condition?" You will see," was all Natasha could say. They sat a little while downstairs near his room, till they had left off crying and were able to go to him with calm faces. "How has his whole illness gone? Is it long since he grew worse?" "When did this happen?" Princess Mary inquired. Natasha told her that at first there had been danger from his feverish condition and the pain he suffered, but at Troitsa that had passed, and the doctor had only been afraid of gangrene. That danger had also passed. When they reached Yaroslavl, the wound had begun to fester. Natasha knew all about such things as festering, and the doctor had said that the festering might take a normal course. Then fever set in, but the doctor had said the fever was not very serious. "But 2 days ago, this suddenly happened," said Natasha, struggling with her sobs. "I don't know why, but you will see what he's like."
"Is he weaker, thinner?" asked the princess.
"No, it's not that, but worse. You will see. Oh, Mary, he's too good. He cannot live because..."
When Natasha opened Prince Andrew's door with a familiar movement and let Princess Mary pass into the room before her, the princess felt the sobs rising in her throat. Hard as she had tried to prepare herself, and now tried to remain tranquil, she knew that she would be unable to look at him without tears. The princess understood what Natasha had meant by the words, 2 days ago, this suddenly happened. She understood those words to mean that he had suddenly softened, and that this softening and gentleness were signs of approaching death. As she stepped to the door, she already saw in imagination Andrew's face as she remembered it in childhood, a gentle, mild, sympathetic face which he had rarely shown and which therefore affected her very strongly. She was sure he would speak soft, tender words to her, such as her father had uttered before his death, and that she would not be able to bear it and would burst into sobs in his presence. Yet sooner or later it had to be, and she went in. The sobs rose higher and higher in her throat as she more and more clearly distinguished his form, and her short-sighted eyes tried to make out his features. And then she saw his face and met his gaze. He was lying in a squirrel-fur dressing gown on a divan, surrounded by pillows. He was thin and pale. In one thin, translucently white hand, he held a handkerchief, while with the other he stroked the delicate moustache he had grown, moving his fingers slowly. His eyes gazed at them as they entered. On seeing his face and meeting his eyes, Princess Mary's pace suddenly slackened. She felt her tears dry up, and her sobs ceased. She suddenly felt guilty, and grew timid on catching the expression of his face and eyes. "But in what am I to blame?" she asked herself. And his cold, stern look replied, "Because you are alive and thinking of the living, while I..." In the deep gaze that seemed to look not outwards but inwards, there was an almost hostile expression as he slowly regarded his sister and Natasha. He kissed his sister, holding her hand in his, as was their wont. "How are you, Mary? How did you manage to get here?" said he in a voice as calm and aloof as his look. Had he screamed in agony, that scream would not have struck such horror into Princess Mary's heart as the tone of his voice. "And have you brought little Nicholas?" he asked in the same slow, quiet manner, and with an obvious effort to remember. "How are you now?" said Princess Mary, herself surprised at what she was saying. "That, my dear, you must ask the doctor," he replied. And again making an evident effort to be affectionate, he said with his lips only, his words clearly did not correspond to his thoughts, "Merci, cher ami, d'être venu. Thank you for coming, my dear." Princess Mary pressed his hand. The pressure made him wince just perceptibly. He was silent, and she did not know what to say. She now understood what had happened to him 2 days before. In his words, his tone, and especially in that calm, almost antagonistic look, could be felt an estrangement from everything belonging to this world, terrible in one who was alive. Evidently, only with an effort did he understand anything living. But it was obvious that he failed to understand, not because he lacked the power to do so, but because he understood something else, something the living did not and could not understand, and which wholly occupied his mind. "There. You see how strangely fate has brought us together?" said he, breaking the silence and pointing to Natasha. "She looks after me all the time." Princess Mary heard him and did not understand how he could say such a thing. He, the sensitive, tender Prince Andrew, how could he say that before her whom he loved and who loved him? Had he expected to live, he could not have said those words in that offensively cold tone. If he had not known that he was dying, how could he have failed to pity her, and how could he speak like that in her presence? The only explanation was that he was indifferent, because something else, much more important, had been revealed to him. The conversation was cold and disconnected and continually broke off. "Mary came by way of Ryazan," said Natasha. Prince Andrew did not notice that she called his sister Mary, and only after calling her so in his presence did Natasha notice it herself. "Really?" he asked. "They told her that all Moscow has been burned down, and that..." Natasha stopped. It was impossible to talk. It was plain that he was making an effort to listen, but could not do so. "Yes, they say it's burned," he said. "It's a great pity." And he gazed straight before him, absently stroking his moustache with his fingers. "And so you've met Count Nicholas, Mary," Prince Andrew suddenly said, evidently wishing to speak pleasantly to them. "He wrote here that he took a great liking to you," he went on simply and calmly, evidently unable to understand all the complex significance his words had for living people. "If you liked him too, it would be a good thing for you to get married," he added rather more quickly, as if pleased at having found words he had long been seeking. Princess Mary heard his words, but they had no meaning for her, except as a proof of how far away he now was from everything living. "Why talk of me?" she said quietly, and glanced at Natasha. Natasha, who felt her glance, did not look at her. All three were again silent. "Andrew, would you like," Princess Mary suddenly said in a trembling voice, "would you like to see little Nicholas? He's always talking about you." Prince Andrew smiled just perceptibly, and for the first time. But Princess Mary, who knew his face so well, saw with horror that he did not smile with pleasure or affection for his son, but with quiet, gentle irony, because he thought she was trying what she believed to be the last means of arousing him. "Yes, I shall be very glad to see him. Is he quite well?" When little Nicholas was brought into Prince Andrew's room, he looked at his father with frightened eyes, but did not cry, because no one else was crying. Prince Andrew kissed him, and evidently did not know what to say to him. When Nicholas had been led away, Princess Mary again went up to her brother, kissed him, and, unable to restrain her tears any longer, began to cry. He looked at her attentively. "Is it about Nicholas?" he asked. Princess Mary nodded her head, weeping. "Mary, you know the gospel..." But he broke off. "What did you say?" "Nothing. You mustn't cry here," he said, looking at her with the same cold expression. When Princess Mary began to cry, he understood that she was crying at the thought that little Nicholas would be left without a father. With a great effort, he tried to return to life and to see things from their point of view. "Yes, to them it must seem sad," he thought. "But how simple it is. The fowls of the air sow not, neither do they reap. Yet your father feedeth them," he said to himself, and wished to say to Princess Mary. "But no, they will take it their own way. They won't understand. They can't understand that all those feelings they prize so, all our feelings, all those ideas that seem so important to us, are unnecessary. We cannot understand one another." And he remained silent. Prince Andrew's little son was 7. He could scarcely read and knew nothing. After that day, he lived through many things, gaining knowledge, observation, and experience. But had he possessed all the faculties he afterwards acquired, he could not have had a better or more profound understanding of the meaning of the scene he had witnessed between his father, Mary, and Natasha than he had then. He understood it completely, and, leaving the room without crying, went silently up to Natasha, who had come out with him, and looked shyly at her with his beautiful, thoughtful eyes. Then his uplifted, rosy upper lip trembled, and leaning his head against her, he began to cry. After that, he avoided de Salle and the Countess, who caressed him, and either sat alone or came timidly to Princess Mary,
or to Natasha, of whom he seemed even fonder than of his aunt, and clung to them quietly and shyly. When Princess Mary had left Prince Andrew, she fully understood what Natasha's face had told her. She did not speak any more to Natasha of hopes of saving his life. She took turns with her beside his sofa, and did not cry any more, but prayed continually, turning in soul to that eternal and unfathomable whose presence above the dying man was now so evident. Not only did Prince Andrew know he would die, but he felt that he was dying and was already half dead. He was conscious of an aloofness from everything earthly and a strange and joyous lightness of existence. Without haste or agitation, he awaited what was coming. That inexorable, eternal, distant, and unknown, the presence of which he had felt continually all his life, was now near to him, and by the strange lightness he experienced, almost comprehensible and palpable. Formerly, he had feared the end. He had twice experienced that terribly tormenting fear of death, the end, but now he no longer understood that fear. He had felt it for the first time when the shell spun like a top before him, and he looked at the fallow field, the bushes, and the sky, and knew that he was face to face with death. When he came to himself after being wounded, and the flower of eternal, unfettered love had instantly unfolded itself in his soul as if freed from the bondage of life that had restrained it, he no longer feared death, and ceased to think about it. During the hours of solitude, suffering, and partial delirium he spent after he was wounded, the more deeply he penetrated into the new principle of eternal love revealed to him, the more he unconsciously detached himself from earthly life. To love everything and everybody, and always to sacrifice oneself for love, meant not to love anyone, not to live this earthly life. And the more imbued he became with that principle of love, the more he renounced life, and the more completely he destroyed that dreadful barrier which, in the absence of such love, stands between life and death. When during those first days he remembered that he would have to die, he said to himself, "Well, what of it? So much the better." But after the night in Mytishchi, when half delirious he had seen her for whom he longed appear before him, and having pressed her hand to his lips had shed gentle, happy tears, love for a particular woman again crept unobserved into his heart, and once more bound him to life, and joyful and agitating thoughts began to occupy his mind. Recalling the moment at the ambulance station when he had seen Kuragin, he could not now regain the feeling he then had, but was tormented by the question whether Kuragin was alive, and he dared not inquire. His illness pursued its normal physical course, but what Natasha referred to when she said, "This suddenly happened," had occurred 2 days before Princess Mary arrived. It was the last spiritual struggle between life and death, in which death gained the victory. It was the unexpected realization of the fact that he still valued life as presented to him in the form of his love for Natasha, and a last, though ultimately vanquished, attack of terror before the unknown. It was evening. As usual after dinner, Prince Andrew was slightly feverish, and his thoughts were preternaturally clear. Sonya was sitting by the table. He began to doze. Suddenly a feeling of happiness seized him. "Ah, she has come," thought he. And so it was. In Sonya's place sat Natasha, who had just come in noiselessly. Since she had begun looking after him, he had always experienced this physical consciousness of her nearness. She was sitting in an armchair, placed sideways, screening the light of the candle from him, and was knitting a stocking. She had learned to knit the stocking since Prince Andrew had casually mentioned that no one nursed the sick so well as old nurses who knit stockings, and that there is something soothing in the knitting of stockings. The needles clicked lightly in her slender, rapidly moving hands, and he could clearly see the thoughtful profile of her drooping face. She moved, and the ball rolled off her knees. She started, glanced round at him, and, screening the candle with her hand, stooped carefully with a supple and exact movement, picked up the ball, and regained her former position. He looked at her without moving, and saw that she wanted to draw a deep breath after stooping, but refrained from doing so, and breathed cautiously. At the Troitzer Monastery, they had spoken of the past, and he had told her that if he lived, he would always thank God for his wound, which had brought them together again. But after that, they never spoke of the future. Can it or can it not be, he now thought, as he looked at her and listened to the light click of the steel needles. Can fate have brought me to her so strangely, only for me to die? Is it possible that the truth of life has been revealed to me only to show me that I've spent my life in falsity? I love her more than anything in the world. But what am I to do if I love her? He thought, and he involuntarily groaned from a habit acquired during his sufferings. On hearing that sound, Natasha put down the stocking, leaned nearer to him, and suddenly, noticing his shining eyes, stepped lightly up to him and bent over him. You're not asleep? No. I've been looking at you a long time. I felt you come in. No one else gives me that sense of soft tranquility that you do. That light. I want to weep for joy. Natasha drew closer to him. Her face shone with rapturous joy. Natasha, I love you too much, more than anything in the world. And I, she turned away for an instant. Why too much? She asked. Why too much? Well, what do you think? What do you feel in your soul, your whole soul? Shall I live? What do you think? I'm sure of it, sure, Natasha almost shouted, taking hold of both his hands with a passionate movement. He remained silent a while. How good it would be. And taking her hand, he kissed it. Natasha felt happy and agitated, but at once remembered that this would not do and that he had to be quiet. But you have not slept, she said, repressing her joy. Try to sleep. Please. He pressed her hand and released it, and she went back to the candle and sat down again in her former position. Twice she turned and looked at him, and her eyes met his, beaming at her. She set herself a task on her stocking and resolved not to turn round till it was finished. Soon he really shut his eyes and fell asleep. He did not sleep long, and suddenly awoke with a start and in a cold perspiration. As he fell asleep, he had still been thinking of the subject that now always occupied his mind, about life and death, and chiefly about death. He felt himself nearer to it. Love? What is love? He thought. Love hinders death. Love is life. All, everything that I understand only because I love. Everything is, everything exists, only because I love. Everything is united by it alone. Love is God, and to die means that I, a particle of love, shall return to the general and eternal source. These thoughts seemed to him comforting, but they were only thoughts. Something was lacking in them. They were not clear. They were too one-sidedly personal and brain-spun. And there was the former agitation and obscurity. He fell asleep. He dreamed that he was lying in the room he really was in, but that he was quite well and unwounded. Many various, indifferent, and insignificant people appeared before him. He talked to them and discussed something trivial. They were preparing to go away somewhere. Prince Andrew dimly realized that all this was trivial, and that he had more important cares. but he continued to speak, surprising them by empty witticisms. Gradually, unnoticed, all these persons began to disappear, and a single question, that of the closed door, superseded all else. He rose and went to the door to bolt and lock it. Everything depended on whether he was or was not in time to lock it. He went and tried to hurry, but his legs refused to move, and he knew he would not be in time to lock the door, though he painfully strained all his powers. He was seized by an agonizing fear, and that fear was the fear of death. It stood behind the door. But just when he was clumsily creeping toward the door, that dreadful something on the other side was already pressing against it and forcing its way in. Something not human, death, was breaking in through that door and had to be kept out. He seized the door, making a final effort to hold it back. To lock it was no longer possible, but his efforts were weak and clumsy, and the door, pushed from behind by that terror, opened and closed again. Once again, it pushed from outside. His last superhuman efforts were vain, and both halves of the door noiselessly opened. It entered, and it was death, and Prince Andrew died. But at the instant he died, Prince Andrew remembered that he was asleep, and at the very instant he died, having made an effort, he awoke. Yes, it was death. I died and woke up. Yes, death is an awakening. And all at once it grew light in his soul, and the veil that had till then concealed the unknown was lifted from his spiritual vision. He felt as if powers till then confined within him had been liberated, and that strange lightness did not again leave him. When, waking in a cold perspiration, he moved on the divan, Natasha went up and asked him what was the matter. He did not answer, and looked at her strangely, not understanding. That was what had happened to him 2 days before Princess Mary's arrival. From that day, as the doctor expressed it, the wasting fever assumed a malignant character. But what the doctor said did not interest Natasha. She saw the terrible moral symptoms, which to her were more convincing. From that day, an awakening from life came to Prince Andrew, together with his awakening from sleep. And compared to the duration of life, it did not seem to him slower than an awakening from sleep compared to the duration of a dream. There was nothing terrible or violent in this comparatively slow awakening. His last days and hours passed in an ordinary and simple way. Both Princess Mary and Natasha, who did not leave him, felt this. They did not weep or shudder, and during these last days they themselves felt that they were not attending on him. He was no longer there, he had left them. But on what reminded them most closely of him, his body. Both felt this so strongly that the outward and terrible side of death did not affect them, and they did not feel it necessary to foment their grief. Neither in his presence nor out of it did they weep, nor did they ever talk to one another about him. They felt that they could not express in words what they understood. They both saw that he was sinking slowly and quietly, deeper and deeper, away from them. And they both knew that this had to be so, and that it was right. He confessed and received communion. Everyone came to take leave of him. When they brought his son to him, he pressed his lips to the boy's and turned away. Not because he felt it hard and sad, Princess Mary and Natasha understood that, but simply because he thought it was all that was required of him. But when they told him to bless the boy, he did what was demanded and looked round as if asking whether there was anything else he should do. When the last convulsions of the body which the spirit was leaving occurred, Princess Mary and Natasha were present. "Is it over?" said Princess Mary, when his body had for a few minutes lain motionless, growing cold before them. Natasha went up, looked at the dead eyes, and hastened to close them. She closed them, but did not kiss them, but clung to that which reminded her most nearly of him, his body. "Where is he gone? Where is he now?" When the body, washed and dressed, lay in the coffin on a table, everyone came to take leave of him, and they all wept. Little Nicholas cried because his heart was rent by painful perplexity. The Countess and Sonia cried from pity for Natasha, and because he was no more. The old Count cried because he felt that before long he too must take the same terrible step. Natasha and Princess Mary also wept now, but not because of their own personal grief. They wept with a reverent and softening emotion which had taken possession of their souls at the consciousness of the simple and solemn mystery of death that had been accomplished in their presence. Book 13. Dates of Principal Historical Events, 1812. Old Style, October 6th, Battle of Tarutino. October 6th, 7th, and 8th, the French leave Moscow. October 12th, Battle of Maloyaroslavets. October 21st, Cossacks harry the French at Vyazma. Chapter 1. The Cause of Historical Events. A Survey of Movements of the Russian Army After Leaving Moscow. Napoleon's Letter to Kutuzov. The Camp at Tarutino. Alexander's Letters to Kutuzov. Ermolov and Others Absent When Wanted. The Battle Postponed. Kutuzov's Wrath. The Action Next Day. Cossacks Surprise Murat's Army and Capture Prisoners, Guns, and Booty. Inactivity of the Rest of the Army. Man's mind cannot grasp the causes of events in their completeness, but the desire to find those causes is implanted in man's soul. And without considering the multiplicity and complexity of the conditions, any one of which taken separately may seem to be the cause, he snatches at the first approximation to a cause that seems to him intelligible and says, "This is the cause." In historical events, where the actions of men are the subject of observation, the first and most primitive approximation to present itself was the will of the gods, and after that, the will of those who stood in the most prominent position, the heroes of history. But we need only penetrate to the essence of any historic event, which lies in the activity of the general mass of men who take part in it, to be convinced that the will of the historic hero does not control the actions of the mass, but is itself continually controlled. It may seem to be a matter of indifference whether we understand the meaning of historical events this way or that, yet there is the same difference between a man who says that the people of the West moved on the East because Napoleon wished it, and a man who says that this happened because it had to happen, as there is between those who declared that the earth was stationary and that the planets moved round it, and those who admitted that they did not know what upheld the earth, but knew there were laws directing its movement and that of the other planets. There is and can be no cause of an historical event except the one cause of all causes. But there are laws directing events, and some of these laws are known to us, while we are conscious of others we cannot comprehend. The discovery of these laws is only possible when we have quite abandoned the attempt to find the cause in the will of some one man, just as the discovery of the laws of the motion of the planets was possible only when men abandoned the conception of the fixity of the earth. The historians consider that next to the Battle of Borodino and the occupation of Moscow by the enemy and its destruction by fire, The most important episode of the War of 1812 was the movement of the Russian army from the Ryazan to the Kaluga Road and to the Tarutino camp, the so-called flank march across the Krasnaya Pakhra River. They ascribe the glory of that achievement of genius to different men, and dispute as to whom the honor is due. Even foreign historians, including the French, acknowledge the genius of the Russian commanders when they speak of that flank march. But it is hard to understand why military writers, and following them others, consider this flank march to be the profound conception of some one man who saved Russia and destroyed Napoleon. In the first place, it is hard to understand where the profundity and genius of this movement lay, for not much mental effort was needed to see that the best position for an army when it is not being attacked is where there are most provisions. And even a dull boy of 13 could have guessed that the best position for an army after its retreat from Moscow in 1812 was on the Kaluga Road. So it is impossible to understand by what reasoning the historians reached the conclusion that this maneuver was a profound one. And it is even more difficult to understand just why they think that this maneuver was calculated to save Russia and destroy the French. For this flank march, had it been preceded, accompanied, or followed by other circumstances, might have proved ruinous to the Russians and salutary for the French. If the position of the Russian army really began to improve from the time of that march, it does not at all follow that the march was the cause of it. That flank march might not only have failed to give any advantage to the Russian army, but might in other circumstances have led to its destruction. What would have happened had Moscow not burned down? If Murat had not lost sight of the Russians? If Napoleon had not remained inactive? If the Russian army at Krasnaya Pakhra had given battle as Bennigsen and Barclay advised? What would have happened had the French attacked the Russians while they were marching beyond the Pakhra? What would have happened if, on approaching Tarutino, Napoleon had attacked the Russians with but a tenth of the energy he had shown when he attacked them at Smolensk? What would have happened had the French moved on Petersburg? In any of these eventualities, the flank march that brought salvation might have proved disastrous. The third and most incomprehensible thing is that people studying history deliberately avoid seeing that this flank march cannot be attributed to any one man, that no one ever foresaw it, and that in reality, like the retreat from Filly, it did not suggest itself to anyone in its entirety, but resulted, moment by moment, step by step, event by event, from an endless number of most diverse circumstances, and was only seen in its entirety when it had been accomplished and belonged to the past. At the council at Filly, the prevailing thought in the minds of the Russian commanders was the one naturally suggesting itself, namely, a direct retreat by the Nizhny Road. In proof of this, there is the fact that the majority of the council voted for such a retreat. And above all, there is the well-known conversation after the council between the commander-in-chief and Lanskoy, who was in charge of the commissariat department. Lanskoy informed the commander-in-chief that the army supplies were for the most part stored along the Oka in the Tula and Ryazan provinces, and that if they retreated on Nizhny, the army would be separated from its supplies by the broad river Oka, which cannot be crossed early in winter. This was the first indication of the necessity of deviating from what had previously seemed the most natural course, a direct retreat on Nizhny Novgorod. The army turned more to the south, along the Ryazan Road, and nearer to its supplies. Subsequently, the inactivity of the French, who even lost sight of the Russian army, concern for the safety of the arsenal at Tula, and especially the advantages of drawing nearer to its supplies, caused the army to turn still further south to the Tula Road. Having crossed over by a forced march to the Tula Road beyond the Pakhra, the Russian commanders intended to remain at Podolsk and had no thought of the Tarutino position. But innumerable circumstances, and the reappearance of French troops who had for a time lost touch with the Russians, and projects of giving battle, and above all, the abundance of provisions in Kaluga province, obliged our army to turn still more to the south and to cross from the Tula to the Kaluga road and go to Tarutino, which was between the roads along which those supplies lay. Just as it is impossible to say when it was decided to abandon Moscow, so it is impossible to say precisely when or by whom it was decided to move to Tarutino. Only when the army had got there, as the result of innumerable and varying forces, did people begin to assure themselves that they had desired this movement and long ago foreseen its result. The famous flank movement merely consisted in this. After the advance of the French had ceased, the Russian army, which had been continually retreating straight back from the invaders, deviated from that direct course, and, not finding itself pursued, was naturally drawn toward the district where supplies were abundant. If, instead of imagining to ourselves commanders of genius leading the Russian army, we pictured that army without any leaders, it could not have done anything but make a return movement toward Moscow, describing an arc in the direction where most provisions were to be found and where the country was richest. That movement, from the Nizhny to the Ryazan, Tula, and Kaluga roads, was so natural that even the Russian marauders moved in that direction, and demands were sent from Petersburg for Kutuzov to take his army that way. At Tarutino, Kutuzov received what was almost a reprimand from the emperor for having moved his army along the Ryazan road, and the emperor's letter indicated to him the very position he had already occupied near Kaluga. Having rolled like a ball in the direction of the impetus given by the whole campaign and by the Battle of Borodino, the Russian army, when the strength of that impetus was exhausted and no fresh push was received, assumed the position natural to it. Kutuzov's merit lay not in any strategic maneuver of genius, as it is called, but in the fact that he alone understood the significance of what had happened. He alone then understood the meaning of the French army's inactivity. He alone continued to assert that the Battle of Borodino had been a victory. He alone, who as commander-in-chief might have been expected to be eager to attack, employed his whole strength to restrain the Russian army from useless engagements. The beast, wounded at Borodino, was lying where the fleeing hunter had left him. But whether he was still alive, whether he was strong and merely lying low, the hunter did not know. Suddenly the beast was heard to moan. The moan of that wounded beast, the French army, which betrayed its calamitous condition, was the sending of Lauriston to Kutuzov's camp with overtures for peace. Napoleon, with his usual assurance that whatever entered his head was right, wrote to Kutuzov the first words that occurred to him, though they were meaningless. Monsieur le Prince Kutuzov, I am sending one of my adjutants general to discuss several interesting questions with you. I beg your highness to credit what he says to you, especially when he expresses the sentiment of esteem and special regard I have long entertained for your person. This letter, having no other object, I pray God, Monsieur le Prince Kutuzov, to keep you in his holy and gracious protection. Napoleon, Moscow, October 30th, 1812. Kutuzov replied, I should be cursed by posterity were I looked on as the initiator of a settlement of any sort. Such is the present spirit of my nation. But he continued to exert all his powers to restrain his troops from attacking. During the month that the French troops were pillaging in Moscow and the Russian troops were quietly encamped at Tarutino, a change had taken place in the relative strength of the two armies, both in spirit and in number, as a result of which the superiority had passed to the Russian side. Though the condition and numbers of the French army were unknown to the Russians, as soon as that change occurred, the need of attacking at once showed itself by countless signs. These signs were Lauriston's mission, the abundance of provisions at Tarutino, the reports coming in from all sides of the inactivity and disorder of the French, the flow of recruits to our regiments, the fine weather, the long rest the Russian soldiers had enjoyed, and the impatience to do what they had been assembled for, which usually shows itself in an army that has been resting. Curiosity as to what the French army, so long lost sight of, was doing. The boldness with which our outposts now scouted close up to the French stationed at Tarutino. The news of easy successes gained by peasants and guerrilla troops over the French. The envy aroused by this. The desire for revenge that lay in the heart of every Russian as long as the French were in Moscow. And, above all, a dim consciousness in every soldier's mind that the relative strength of the armies had changed and that the advantage was now on our side. There was a substantial change in the relative strength, and an advance had become inevitable. And at once, as a clock begins to strike and chime as soon as the minute hand has completed a full circle, this change was shown by an increased activity, whirring and chiming in the higher spheres. The Russian army was commanded by Kutuzov and his staff, and also by the Emperor from Petersburg. Before the news of the abandonment of Moscow had been received in Petersburg, a detailed plan of the whole campaign had been drawn up and sent to Kutuzov for his guidance. Though this plan had been drawn up on the supposition that Moscow was still in our hands, it was approved by the staff and accepted as a basis for action. Kutuzov only replied that movements arranged from a distance were always difficult to execute. So fresh instructions were sent for the solution of difficulties that might be encountered, as well as fresh people who were to watch Kutuzov's actions and report upon them. Besides this, the whole staff of the Russian army was now reorganized. The posts left vacant by Bagration, who had been killed, and by Barclay, who had gone away in dudgeon, had to be filled. Very serious consideration was given to the question whether it would be better to put A in B's place and B in D's, or, on the contrary, to put D in A's place, and so on, as if anything more than A's or B's satisfaction depended on this. As a result of the hostility between Kutuzov and Bennigsen, his chief of staff, the presence of confidential representatives of the Emperor and these transfers, a more than usually complicated play of parties was going on among the staff of the army. A was undermining B, D was undermining C, and so on in all possible combinations and permutations. In all these plottings, the subject of intrigue was generally the conduct of the war, which all these men believed they were directing. But this affair of the war went on independently of them, as it had to go, that is, never in the way people devised, but flowing always from the essential attitude of the masses. Only in the highest spheres did all these schemes, crossings, and interminglings appear to be a true reflection of what had to happen. Prince Michael Ilarionovich, wrote the Emperor on the 2nd of October in a letter that reached Kutuzov after the battle at Tarutino. Since September 2nd, Moscow has been in the hands of the enemy. Your last reports were written on the 20th, and during all this time, not only has no action been taken against the enemy or for the relief of the ancient capital, but according to your last report, you have even retreated farther. Serpukhov is already occupied by an enemy detachment, and Tula, with its famous arsenal, so indispensable to the army, is in danger. From General Wintzingerode's reports, I see that an enemy corps of 10,000 men is moving on the Petersburg Road. Another corps of several thousand men is moving on Dmitrov. A third has advanced along the Vladimir Road, and a fourth, rather considerable detachment, is stationed between Ruza and Mozhaisk. Napoleon himself was in Moscow as late as the 25th. In view of all this information, when the enemy has scattered his forces in large detachments, and with Napoleon and his guards in Moscow, is it possible that the enemy's forces confronting you are so considerable as not to allow of your taking the offensive? On the contrary, he is probably pursuing you with detachments, or at most with an army corps much weaker than the army entrusted to you. It would seem that, availing yourself of these circumstances, you might advantageously attack a weaker enemy and annihilate him, or at least oblige him to retreat, retaining in our hands an important part of the provinces now occupied by the enemy, and thereby averting danger from Tula and other towns in the interior. You will be responsible if the enemy is able to direct a force of any size against Petersburg to threaten this capital in which it has not been possible to retain many troops. For with the army entrusted to you, and acting with resolution and energy, you have ample means to avert this fresh calamity. Remember that you have still to answer to our offended country for the loss of Moscow. You have experienced my readiness to reward you. That readiness will not weaken in me. But I and Russia have a right to expect from you all the zeal, firmness, and success which your intellect, military talent, and the courage of the troops you command justify us in expecting. But by the time this letter, which proved that the real relation of the forces had already made itself felt in Petersburg, was dispatched, Kutuzov had found himself unable any longer to restrain the army he commanded from attacking, and a battle had taken place. On the 2nd of October, a Cossack, Shapovalov, who was out scouting, killed one hare and wounded another. Following the wounded hare, he made his way far into the forest and came upon the left flank of Murat's army and camped there without any precautions. The Cossack laughingly told his comrades how he had almost fallen into the hands of the French. A cornet, hearing the story, informed his commander. The Cossack was sent for and questioned. The Cossack officers wished to take advantage of this chance to capture some horses, but one of the superior officers, who was acquainted with the higher authorities, reported the incident to a general on the staff. The state of things on the staff had of late been exceedingly strained. Yermolov had been to see Bennigsen a few days previously, and had entreated him to use his influence with the commander-in-chief to induce him to take the offensive. "If I did not know you, I should think you did not want what you are asking for. I need only advise anything, and His Highness is sure to do the opposite," replied Bennigsen. The Cossack's report, confirmed by horse patrols who were sent out, was the final proof that events had matured. The tightly coiled spring was released, the clock began to whir, and the chimes to play. Despite all his supposed power, his intellect, his experience, and his knowledge of men, Kutuzov, having taken into consideration the Cossack's report, a note from Bennigsen, who sent personal reports to the Emperor, the wishes he supposed the Emperor to hold, and the fact that all the generals expressed the same wish, could no longer check the inevitable movement and gave the order to do what he regarded as useless and harmful, gave his approval, that is, to the accomplished fact. Bennigsen's note and the Cossack's information that the left flank of the French was unguarded were merely final indications that it was necessary to order an attack, and it was fixed for the 5th of October. On the morning of the 4th of October, Kutuzov signed the dispositions. Toll read them to Yermolov, asking him to attend to the further arrangements. All right, I haven't time just now, replied Yermolov, and left the hut. The dispositions were drawn up by Toll, and they were very good. As in the Austerlitz dispositions, it was written, though not in German this time, "The first column will march here and here, the second column will march here and there," and so on. And on paper, all these columns arrived at their places at the appointed time and destroyed the enemy. Everything had been admirably thought out, as is usual in dispositions, and, as is always the case, not a single column reached its place at the appointed time. When the necessary number of copies of the dispositions had been prepared, an officer was summoned and sent to deliver them to Yermolov to deal with. A young officer of the Horse Guards, Kutuzov's orderly, pleased at the importance of the mission entrusted to him, went to Yermolov's quarters. "Gone away," said Yermolov's orderly. The officer of the Horse Guards went to a general with whom Yermolov was often to be found. "No. And the general's out, too." The officer, mounting his horse, rode off to someone else. "No, he's gone out. If only they don't make me responsible for this delay. What a nuisance it is," thought the officer.
and he rode round the whole camp. One man said he had seen Ermolov ride past with some other generals. Others said he must have returned home. The officer searched till 6 o'clock in the evening without even stopping to eat. Ermolov was nowhere to be found, and no one knew where he was. The officer snatched a little food at a comrade's and rode again to the vanguard to find Miloradovich. Miloradovich, too, was away. But here he was told that he had gone to a ball at General Kikin's and that Ermolov was probably there, too. But where is it? Why, there, over at Echkino, said a Cossack officer, pointing to a country house in the far distance. What, outside our line? Oh, they've put two regiments as outposts, and they're having such a spree there. It's awful. Two bands and three sets of singers. The officer rode out beyond our lines to Echkino. While still at a distance, he heard as he rode the merry sounds of a soldier's dance song proceeding from the house. In the meadows, he heard, accompanied by whistling and the sound of a torban, a Ukrainian stringed instrument resembling the balalaika, drowned every now and then by shouts. These sounds made his spirits rise, but at the same time he was afraid that he would be blamed for not having executed sooner the important order entrusted to him. It was already past 8 o'clock. He dismounted and went up into the porch of a large country house which had remained intact between the Russian and French forces. In the refreshment room and the hall, footmen were bustling about with wine and viands. Groups of singers stood outside the windows. The officer was admitted and immediately saw all the chief generals of the army together, and among them Ermolov's big, imposing figure. They all had their coats unbuttoned and were standing in a semicircle with flushed and animated faces, laughing loudly. In the middle of the room, a short, handsome general with a red face was dancing the trepak with much spirit and agility.
Ha ha ha! Bravo, Nicholas Ivanich! Ha ha ha!